I'm Sam, an alcoholic, and these are the AA promises. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.
This reading is based on the passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual and our personal stories describe their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeaker.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And tonight I'll introduce David, our speaker.
Thank you. My name is David. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm also an introvert. So my sobriety date is April 5th, 2009. This will be the first time I've told my story in 4 years. And when Tim asked me to tell my story at the 5:45 a few weeks ago, I thought, I should probably say yes. But I did also think, that will teach me to go to 5:45 on a Monday. So, you know, I'm hoping after tonight, Tim's not going to have to beef up his vetting process on this, but we'll see. Since I am an introvert and I'm not really overly experienced with sharing, I would like to ask a favor from you guys. If at any point it's boring, if you could just give me one of these, and if at any point it's like the do, don't go there, just do that. And that will help me. I would really appreciate that. So in a general way, as we're supposed to tell our stories, I'm going to try to do that. And they always say, you know, what it used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. And the good thing about AA is I found it's really one of the only places where you can ask someone, so how crazy are you right now? And it's considered like polite chit-chat. But that said, I really don't like stories where it's like who can out crazy who. So I am not going to do that at all. But I'm just going to try to tell some stories about me on how I got here, just to show really my progression and my inability to deal with life without using alcohol as a crutch. And I think we all have in common that it took a lot of pain and a lot of damage, both to ourselves and our friends and our families, to get here to this free seat. It's definitely the most expensive free seat I've ever sat in. And that said, before I start, I just want to say I really take all responsibility for my alcoholism. So none of these stories are intended to say, poor me, or here's what happened, because it's all on me. I'll start off with my parents. We moved to Atlanta when I was in second grade. My parents rarely drank. And after I was 13, they never drank. And my mom just was really deaf on alcohol. She had two brothers that were alcoholics. And, you know, at the time, I think I knew that, you know, this is like a genetic link in this, but as a teenager, that really does not sink in. And it still never sank in. And I wish it had, but the genetics just didn't register. I have a younger sister and a younger brother. They've never had an issue with alcohol. So I'm special. My mom was a huge extrovert. My dad was more introverted, like myself, but he was a great storyteller. And, you know, I think I had great parents. I feel sure they loved each other, but I'm not sure they liked each other. I don't know if anybody can relate to that. But, you know, I just never really looked at that marriage and thought, I want to get me some of that. I just thought, you know, my brother and sister and I would sometimes discuss, we think they should get divorced. And there was some magazine my mom got that had a monthly column that was called Can This Marriage Be Saved? And we would like go in my sister's room and like read it, analyze it, and you know, say, I don't think it can based on that. But really the only other unusual thing in my childhood is pretty normal. At age 6 I was a model, and ladies, feel free to laugh. It's really, my mom got, she was a big entrepreneur. She got it in her head that, you know what, we can make some money as a family. Let's all model. And my dad did not buy in on it. But the rest of us all did. And so we always said, you know, on the shoots we had like a faux pas because my dad wouldn't do it. So it was some other dude pretending to be our dad on these photo shoots. I did well in school, but I really was always introverted. And, even from kindergarten, I found my old kindergarten notes at one point from the teacher, and one of her comments was, David prefers the company of adults, because I think I would just, you know, try to hang with her, follow her around. Let's jump to high school, because we're all here to talk about alcohol. In high school, at least in mine, there was kind of like three cliques. You had the jocks, the brains, and as we call them, the freaks. I weighed about 110, soaking wet, and was not that coordinated, so you can probably guess I was not a jock. I really was not a freak. I was really kind of a goody-two-shoes in most of high school. So I guess I was more leaning toward the brain group. But the good thing was I had friends in all three groups, and being funny helped. I mean, if you can be funny with all three groups, people want to have you around. And so that was something I always, you know, tried to do. I do remember a particular friend who was in the freak group that would always say to me, you are so funny. We want to see you drunk because we think you would be so funny. And, you know, we really should have stayed in touch because they missed out several hundred chances to see me. my first exposure to alcohol was at age 15 at a school-sponsored convention. And, actually, and I don't know if I've ever seen anybody do this, but as it happens to be, I actually have a picture of myself from age 15 that was taken just a few hours before I had my first drink. And it is rather ironic. Yeah. Now, I'm older, but I'm not that old. I was dressed up, but and it was not the George Stickel Tennessee whiskey that I drank. But later at this convention, oh, and to show you what a hellraiser I was, it was an annual staff convention. So you know those people party. But one of my friends, who looked like he was like 20, and he was also 15, one of the teachers just thought, okay, yeah, I can supply you with some rum. So myself, him, and two girls we had met were in their hotel room with plenty of rum. And now, as a parent now, that's horrifying. I mean, especially courtesy of DeKalb County Schools. That just doesn't seem good. But, so, you know, I would have made a horrible pirate. I do not like rum, and I found that out. So I was just kind of, you know, faking it, you know. But the other people were really imbibing in the rum. And, you know, my date, which I wouldn't even call it a date, but it just did not go well. I mean, she was, ended up crying, sick, little freaked out, and you know, I was not even chivalrous enough at age 15 to hold her hair as she drew up. So my second episode with alcohol was about a year later, and a coworker brought a six pack to work. And we thought, oh, that's a good idea. You know, so we all had a beer. Now, this was, I mean, I guess I'm, you know, getting that checked off quick. Drinking at work, and also it was at an elementary school. I liked it. And that was the first time, you know, a little bit, the light switch flicked on. I did like it. And a few months later, at the elementary school, I should say, I was not a teacher. I was an after-school janitor. So that was how I rationalized it, but I'm sure I would have been promptly fired. But a few months later, one of my janitor friends got married, and I was invited to the reception, and I went by myself, and more beer. And that, you know, had a couple, and it was like the wonder drug. I just felt like, wow, I can totally talk to people. I'm totally comfortable. This is fun. I'm relaxed. So then it was time to drive home. And, you know, I was just, I think, 16 at the time, new driver, so you're already nervous. But I had the death grip at 10 and 2 because I was in the good station wagon. You know, and plus I was going home to my parents who were deaf on alcohol. So I thought, okay, you know, just slide in the house, you know, just maybe go up, brush my teeth, maybe change clothes or whatever. You know, already trying to hide it, you know, from so. And I thought, you know, this will be fine. Well, I walked in, and you had to walk in, and then up a few stairs was the kitchen. My entire family, plus my girlfriend, were all in the kitchen making marinated coleslaw. I mean, you can't make up stuff like this. And I was like, did we turn Amish? What happened? Why? You know, but I think my girlfriend kind of caught my deer in the headlights look, and she's like, hey, let's go for a walk. Because she could tell. And so we did go for a walk, and already hiding it, I slipped by. My parents never knew. So after in high school also, and this is the next progression of my drinking, one of the things I was on a camera crew for a live program, and so I kind of had a good aptitude for camera work. So I liked it, and I decided I wanted to go into television production. And that led to me getting a talent scholarship in telecommunications at a very, very conservative university in Oklahoma. And I don't know if we're supposed to mention names, so I won't, but the initials of the school were ORU. And that, my friends, is where I learned to drink. Seriously. That school does have an honor code. We all signed, and myself included, you will not drink, you will not smoke, you will not engage in any promiscuous behavior. And my friends, I can look you all straight in the eye and tell you, I did not smoke. And funny, at that school, I was considered somewhat of a rebel, which is hilarious, considering, you know, on Friday nights in high school, I was at home thinking Love Boat was God's punishment for not having a girlfriend. there, I did learn to drink more on a regular basis with the TV crew. And so after 2 years at ORU, my sister, who's a year younger, who was also at ORU, got Hodgkin's disease, and we came back to Atlanta. And just for financial reasons, I finished up at Georgia State. And there is where I just strictly went to school, still living at home, no drinking, because my parents were totally deaf on that. So it really, really wasn't balanced, you know. So I went from kind of one not real world university to another not typical college environment. But I was determined to maybe make up for that after graduation. And so I got a job after Georgia State with a major corporation here in Atlanta that flies airplanes. And but a big event happened to me when I was 24. And this all happened in a space of 2 weeks. And in no way am I blaming this, but it just, I did not handle it well. My mom was on a trip and got ill and passed away. And during the 2 weeks that she was in the hospital, my girlfriend, the marinated coleslaw girlfriend, who had dated for 7 years, decided, I think it's time to call this quits. And so those were kind of two big whammies on me. And then my dad, I mean, God bless him, I mean, he was, you know, devastated, but he wasn't handling it that well either. And because it seemed like he got a girlfriend really quick. Like, we thought he was maybe holding hands at the funeral. And that, so our family basically kind of imploded in about 3 weeks. And before, it had been all of us there. And I am here to say I did not handle that well. And really, just kind of wanting to numb emotional pain and things like that, I just kind of went on about a year and a half bender, really, because there was really no accountability. You know, parents are gone. So my sister and I, at that point, my brother was in school in Tennessee. And but one of the things about that, as I started drinking more regularly, is I got incredibly social. And really, to this day, that's probably the most social I've ever been in my whole life. And I guess that just says something about, you know, maybe some of our natures. You know, we're kind of introverted. But I decided, okay, I'm just going to completely remake myself, you know. And so, you know, I did really smart things like buy a Porsche. And, you know, that and drinking isn't a bad combination. And especially when you're 24 and you're just not handling things well in life. I did not have a DUI or an accident, but I certainly qualified for both. And it is a blessing that did not happen. During that year and a half, I know I had at least one time where I felt absolutely sure I had alcohol poisoning. Two friends stayed with me. They did not take me to the emergency room, but they stayed with me that night. And I remember just feeling like death. But by about 5 o'clock the next day after that, I was having a beer. And so even then, I could tell I'm starting to go off the rails a little bit. And there was a coworker who I really liked. And I asked her out. And we had been friends. But I said to her, you know, I think I might be an alcoholic. And I think, like eHarmony says, that's called like a non-starter when you say that, when you're asking somebody out. For some reason, she decided not to want to date me. But she said, I have a friend that you should meet. And really, what I did not know about women could fill a book. But my first date with this friend, and I'm only telling this briefly to show my thinking and the progression. I met her at a party. We were there. We were supposed to go to dinner. Within like 2 minutes, she had spilled a drink on me. Now, in my mind, I thought that was flirting. You know, she's like, oh, it's okay. I can just loan you a pair of shorts and we can still go to dinner. Why I thought that was a good idea, I don't know. So I had sorority shorts on. We went to dinner. We were there for about 2 minutes, and she put her head down on the table. Now, we all know that's a bad sign when you have to put your head down the table. Then she promptly bolted. Because I was wearing her sorority shorts with no pockets, she had my wallet. And she just bolted. I later went outside, looked around, did not see her anywhere in the parking lot, went back behind the restaurant, and she was in the dirt, sick. But the fact is, alcohol is cunning, baffling, powerful. We dated for 3 months. because that was somebody that drank like me, and I did not think that was like a showstopper just that one time. And she did help me get in touch a little bit with my higher power, because I was praying, dear God, please do not let this girl throw up in my Porsche. So it was just really where I think I was looking for people that would accept me, not judge me, drink like me. The highlight of the social, before we get to the rapid downhill, and this does have bearing later in the story, was I decided to have this tacky party. And it was a huge success. We wanted everybody to dress as tacky as they could, went all out, decorated the house as tacky as I could. I mean, I was in my 20s, but like 50-year-old neighbors were crashing this party. It was a huge success. In that first tacky party, two couples met that ended up getting married. The second year, I had another one. That year, I was dressed like Elvis. The two marriages came out of that tacky party, too. Both of them, me. So, my first wife I met dressed as Elvis, complete with the wig. And I was the later Elvis, though, because I was drunk. You know, and so Now, the second marriage, that was 20 years later. So my first wife, after 9 years, we had a wonderful daughter who is just such a blessing. She just graduated from college a week ago. So proud of her. And but at that point, then after the divorce, I was still keeping friends that I had been drinking with that whole time, specifically one best friend. And they say, you got to change your playmates and playgrounds, but I was still keeping that same friend. My wife really did not drink. She had such a low tolerance for alcohol, like one drink and that was it. And so that started the hiding it thing, where you would get so stressed out, especially then after I was a new dad. I had that perfectionism thing where maybe all new dads have this, but you just determine you want to be a good dad, you want to do everything right. And it is scary being a parent, isn't it? There's no instruction book. But, there was hiding of alcohol, down in the basement. And that's not normal, really. I mean, who thinks like a warm 12-pack of beer is tasty? It's really not. But my world really was shrinking at that point. And at that point, after 13 years, there was a divorce, which led to more isolation. We isolate more. I was determined never again. I'm never going to, be married again, or definitely want to go through a divorce again, because I would not wish that on anyone. It's just an emotional roller coaster. And I'm just so grateful for my daughter. One of the signs where I really knew, I've totally crossed the line on this is I used to pick her up after school. She was at an after school program at a church, and we would always meet in the library there and do homework. I would get to hang out with her. It was great. And I remember one time, just out of the corner of my eye, I saw this book that said, "I'll Quit Tomorrow." Mm-hmm. And I was like, whoa, I know what that has to be about, because I had said that so many times to myself. And she got up to, go to the bathroom or something, and I went over to that book and like, yep, it's what I thought. It's about drinking. And I had tried. We have willpower, but we don't have willpower over that. And during that time, I had become more secretive, I was avoiding my family, brothers, sisters. My dad later had Alzheimer's. I was not there for him as much as I should have been, because a lot of times, like on the weekend or something, really too impaired to drive up there. And I'm not proud of that at all. He knew I loved him, but I did not come into the program until after he passed away. And brother, who I'm now close to, who was instrumental in getting me here, we went 7 years without seeing each other. So, I'm so glad for this program, because a lot's healed in my family. Well, let's jump to late 2005, because this is the downward spiral. And so the girlfriend, the marinated coleslaw girlfriend, that we dated 7 years and decided we were not going to get married. Well, I heard through my sister that her husband, and we had had no contact in almost 20 years, her husband had died. And for some reason, I said to my sister, you know what? She was really a part of our family. We should really go there and support her. And you know what? Most sentient beings would say, bad idea, right? I mean, like, if this was a horror story, would somebody be yelling at the screen right now, like, don't go! Don't go! But I went. And now, I was still drinking, not that day, but... Now, some people would say this is tacky, that I actually gave her my card at the funeral. Is that bad? and it was just, if you ever want to talk, catch up, stuff like that. A couple months went by, a few emails back and forth, and then we met for tea and started seeing each other. And my friends, that was the start of really getting me into here. Because you can kind of fake it for a short amount of time, at least I could. And she had two kids, two teenagers. And I thought, oh, well, I'm kind of a good dad. I love my daughter. I totally get along with her. But it's way different, isn't it? If you're trying to be a stepdad to two kids that just lost their biological dad, they're going through all kinds of psychological crisis. And I just went into this with the most skewed reality that, oh, this is going to work out fine. Because I had really nothing to base that on. You know, I hadn't spent that much time with them as a family. And I realized after we got married, I cannot hold this together. You know, it was just more and more volatile behavior. And I would think, I need a few drinks just to calm down, just to, you know, if you ever said that, just to take the edge off. But the edge kept getting worse. And I was just trying to cope, but it really wasn't helping me cope. And, you know, I told her at one point, you know, I'm like a volcano of resentment. And it was an actual honest statement, really. And at some point, I was just... things were not going well at work. I'd always had good work reviews and all that, and they're like, you know, you're just really, we're not thinking this is working out that well. We might have to put you on a performance improvement program. And that's serious. I'd never had that happen. And I was just willing, you know, I had that willingness where the door opened enough that I knew I needed help. And my younger brother, who was in Texas, got me on a conference call with one of his clients who used to come to NABA. And I listened. Normally I would not have listened, but I listened respectfully, listened to her. I said, oh yeah, behind REI, I'd never been here or heard of it. But so that next Saturday I went. I came to NABA for my first meeting. And I guess to show you just how, you know, screwed up I was, before I came to that meeting, in the refrigerator, in the back of the salad keeper, I found two beers. And you would have thought I had just won the lottery. And I was determined not to drink anymore, and I thought it was all gone. But those two beers, I'm like, oh my gosh, this, you know, I'll just get rid of these. Never occurred to me to pour them out. You can't let this go to waste. So when I came to the meeting, you know, they said, have you been drinking today? And I'm like, only two. And I really thought they'd say something like, you're not an alcoholic. What are you doing here? But, you know, they said, keep coming back. And I did. My thought was, I don't know if any of you had this thought, oh my God, what have I done to get here? Because I have so royally screwed up. You know, I felt like, are you kidding me? I'm going to have to come here every day. Or, you know, just, I was still in that mindset, like, what have I done? But they said, keep coming back. And I at first tried to talk myself into saying, okay, you know what? I was trying to make a deal with myself in my head that first meeting. I don't have to come back here unless I have another drink. And then I thought, you know, I've said that so many times. So I did keep coming back. And luckily did not have that other drink. I got a sponsor. And started to work the steps. And one of the most amazing things, I guess, that hopefully everybody's had here too, or will, is just when that obsession lifted, that was unbelievable. I mean, to go from somebody that was so obsessed that they drank every day, could not wait to get home to drink, to have three. I would, like, take out the trash and drink, like, within, you know, like, a minute. And to have that obsession lifted, that could only be a higher power thing. And but the big books... as the big book talks about restless, irritable, and discontent, I still was. And my wife said, you know, it's been like 6 weeks since you quit drinking, and your behavior is really unacceptable. And it was. But, you know, I still had all that resentment. And I had to do something to get rid of that. Because, you know, in the big book, I like how it says, you know, the number one offender is resentment. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. So, gradually... and believe me, it's an up and down process for me. You know, I can still have resentment, not toward her or anything like that. But I did come to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore me to sanity. And that was a big change for me, because I had felt like God must be so disappointed in me. And I'd felt like that for years, you know, and just cringe when I thought about that. And gradually... my concept of God just kind of changed to one of, you know, God wants the best for us, does not want us to be miserable. And it's more of a loving God than a punishing, you know, about to thwack you. So, you know, yet again, there was another divorce after 7 years. But I did go through that. It was an emotional roller coaster, but I did go through that without drinking. And I just tried to turn it over to God, as so many friends in the program taught me, and this is steps. You know, we have to let it go. You know, God's in control on this. And if I ask direction from both people in the program, sponsor, and friends. And, you know, I've tried to, since then, you know, make living amends, especially to my daughter. And it was such a good relief to me when I got to have a conversation with her. We were in the airport waiting on a flight in Texas. And I thought, you know what, this is a good time to kind of have the talk. Right, because I had never told her I was an alcoholic, and I tried so hard to hide it from her all those years. And the first thing she said was that when I told her I was getting help in recovery, and you know, and she said, "Good for you." And could anybody say anything nicer, really? The 10th step, I love that one. I do try to do that. I'm trying not to pick and choose here, but. You know, where it says, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. And I like to think of that as kind of like the Pottery Barn step, you know, like, because if you break it, you own it. And I've tried to do that. One thing that is a byproduct of this, and then was in no way my intention, because you can imagine after two marriages, I thought, I'm never going to get married again. But I did have a friend, a bunch of friends here in this program. They were so close and had such a good time together. And gradually, we became more than friends. My dear wife, who just read. And it's just been such an amazing blessing. But none of that would have ever happened, and we both say this, if we had not gone through all those bad things, all those horrible things, all that bad behavior, it just took all of that to get the willingness to try to change ourselves. At least I tried to remake myself a little bit through God, because I was disgusted with who I had become. You know, I really did not like myself. And over those years, it's just been such a gradual process, but ups and downs, but a gradual process. And it really does work. Some of the other promises, I told Sam I was going to say this, when it talks about the fear of economic insecurity will leave us. And I'll tell you, like, when I came in here, I was driving a 9-year-old Camry, and today it's 20 years old. But it's awesome. 320,000 miles. So, yeah, that it just says the fear of it, right? So now, let's see, a few more minutes of full disclosure here about AA, lately in AA. So I cannot in any way claim to be the poster guy for AA, or anybody that I would necessarily want you guys to emulate. Because sometimes my program, we kind of coined a term, and my program could be called lacking and slacking. And that's not a good thing, you know, to have it wax and wane. You know, they always say AA should be a way of life. It just becomes a way of life. And there's times where it is more of a way of life, and then times where it's less of a way of life. And I don't know if any of you ever experienced this, where you get your life back on track, you maybe start going to less meetings, maybe sharing less with your friends. I mean, I've been guilty of that. Or sharing with a sponsor or a sponsee. I do have a sponsee, and you know, I'm embarrassed to even call myself his sponsor, but I did pick somebody that we kind of click, and he's actually more introverted than me. So, you know, we text once a year. I'm just not going to pretend. But we do, when we see each other, we do talk. But one good thing about AA. You know, there's no rules, really, in AA. I like how they call them the suggestions, the steps, even though they say, you know, they suggest you pull the ripcord when you fall out of a plane. But there's no dress code. They don't take attendance. And that is so good, because don't you think all of us would have balked at some of that? You know, I think we all have a little bit of the rebellious streak. So we all get to define our program any way we want to. And I do know my program right now needs some tweaking, so you know I need to get a little bit of that more in the fold. But I do believe, and Noelle, who is my wife's sponsor, always says, you know, God did not get us sober to have us be miserable. And I totally believe that. And so if I'm ever feeling that squirrely and restless, irritable, discontent, it's something going on with me, and a meeting could only help. We went to a meeting last Sunday morning, and you know, it was one of those great ones that click where you just think, wow, I can relate to everything, something that everybody is saying. And that's purely just perception, I think, you know, because I'm sure really every meeting I go to, I could, if I had the right frame of mind, be in that same thing. So, you know, so I'm confessing it. But do I have a desire to drink? Absolutely not. And I just should never forget that it's a daily reprieve. You know, it's contingent on our spiritual fitness. And so I cannot forget that. I do thank God every day for another day of sobriety. So, you know, I hope this doesn't sound like I'm kind of doing the two-step around a fifth step. But for me, I just can't thank the program enough. It did save my life. I have no doubt that if I'd still been drinking for 9 more years, I would not have been here. I wouldn't have been able to see my daughter graduate from college, be a better dad, be there for her, be a husband, that my wife deserves, that kind of husband that's trying for better without alcohol. Well, for me, this has been probably about 4 years worth of sharing. you know, I'm very thankful to AA and to all of you, because we're all on the journey together. So thanks very much.
Thank you, David. You did an amazing job. And Cornbread is going to give out the chips.
So I'm going to go through these chips once, and we have a white chip if you're coming in, coming back. I just want to hug Cornbread. Don't squeeze, homie, don't squeeze. Welcome back, brother. 30 days. 90 days, 6 months, 9 months, any anniversaries, 1 year, multiples.
My name is Mark, and I'm an alcoholic. This is 15 years. I was at a meeting one day, and I went in and out of here 6 years, and I found out that I had to give it away to keep it. I was at a meeting one day, and David walked to the door. We worked the steps. He kept me sober. I kept him sober. He didn't get no problem about going through the steps, and I'm proud of you, man. And he's made me a grand sponsor. But it's just one day at a time. It's no big deals in the AA. Thanks for my sobriety.
Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speaker Meeting tonight.
Killing me. Life out here. get so depressing. Need something to take the edge, you see. I got nowhere to hide, an empty hole inside. It's the bottle, the book, or the gun for me. Seems like everyone's out to get me. Trouble always following me. Feeling like I just can't outrun. Demons that are all around me. The bottle, the book, or the gun.